Good morning. My name is Ian Larson. I'm Director of Public Affairs and Communications here at USIP. I'd like to welcome you to this event on A World Without Nuclear Weapons. Ambassador Richard Solomon, the President of USIP, will be moderating today's event, but I just wanted to make a few very brief comments, if I could, before we begin and before Dick introduces our speakers. We're expecting a capacity crowd here today, as you can see, and we're still expecting more people to come in. Now, it's not uncommon for our events to reach full capacity. It is uncommon for our events to reach full capacity as quickly as this one did. We sent out the invitations for this event on Thursday afternoon last week, and by the time we got back to our offices on Monday morning, we had already reached capacity. So I think that says a little bit about the importance of this event and the level of interest in this event. As we do with all of our public events, we're recording today's conversation. That recording will be posted on our website shortly after the conclusion of the event. Clearly, a lot of other people who can't be in the room with us today will be equally interested. But if we want to have a good recording, we need to make sure that our audio system is operating at full capacity. And if you could all help us by turning off your cell phones, turning off your PDAs. If it is wireless and it can receive a signal, it can interfere with our audio system. So if you wouldn't mind just taking a moment now before we begin the activities today to turn all of those off. And again, the audio from today's event will be posted on our website shortly after the conclusion. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ian, and thank you all for coming. It's obvious, as Ian said, that this is a subject of very substantial interest. And what I'd like to do is make just a few scene-setting remarks, and then we'll turn to what I know will be a very interesting discussion. The issue of nuclear proliferation and what happens to the weapons that have accumulated over the post-World War II era continues to be a major, if not the major, security threat that we all are wrestling with. And I see in the room lots of folks who are specialists in these issues. So I'm not going to be telling you anything. But we are trying to now come to grips in a new context with problems that really have been around since nuclear weapons were invented. It took us, our country, over a decade and a half to evolve a framework to constrain the use, if you like, or the threat of nuclear weapons. It really was the Cuban Missile Crisis that led to the framework that we refer to as MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, the deterrence formula that in the bipolar world of the Cold War established a certain amount of stability to the nuclear standoff. And it came to be that we really had a broad bipartisan consensus that these weapons had ultimately turned out to be more of a threat than an enhancement to our security. And so you had from Robert McNamara at one end of the spectrum, if you like, and Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, at the other, taking the view that a nuclear war could never be won and therefore should never be fought. And in some ways, the core of what we're going to be hearing today grew out of that perspective, out of the Reykjavik summit where President Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev talked about a world without nuclear weapons. And as you know, the Reykjavik summit did generate the agreement to end the deployment to go to zero on the intermediate nuclear force deployments. But as Max Kampelman, who was in the middle of all of that activity at Reykjavik and all that followed, will be talking about what he is trying to do with other colleagues to carry through the vision that grew out of President Reagan's approach to this issue and the Reykjavik summit. But what we discovered, of course, was that despite the ideal, the hope that you could eliminate these weapons, the fact that we were trapped in two fundamental dilemmas related to the creation of nuclear weapons. One is you couldn't uninvent the knowledge of how to create these weapons. And then there was the other practical problem of, all right, if the major powers did away with their weapons, what do you do with the fact that the knowledge was diffusing And you could have a cheater country that, given the power of the weaponry, could reap an enormous influence on world affairs by cheating. So how to deal with these dilemmas as we face the hope of dealing, if not eliminating, these weapons? Now, with the end of the Cold War, things became even worse, as I think all of you know. And we today are in a much more dangerous period regarding these weapons. When the Cold War ended, what the first two issues that we confronted were the so-called loose nukes problem or loose scientists. That is, the Soviets did not have, and indeed we have not shown to have, the kind of control over these weapons that gives us a high level of confidence that they won't diffuse, be stolen, be sold, etc. And then, of course, there's the problem of what do you do with the scientists who had developed the weaponry? Would they be hired off in Iran or other countries we could think of to accelerate the proliferation problem? And then with the end of the Cold War, you had, in a sense, the weakening of the discipline that the two superpowers had imposed on this weaponry during the Cold War period. And so in the 90s, we saw proliferation activities accelerate. India, Pakistan, North Korea, Iraq, Iran, Libya, in a sense, the remarkable degree of constraint on the expansion of the nuclear club that many people had expected, in fact, had not occurred during the Cold War, but did accelerate. And then with 9/11, the whole game really changed in a fundamental way. Why? Because the logic of deterrence that had been central to a mad-dominated world was destroyed with suicide bombing, with the fact that everyone could see that the people who flew those airplanes into the World Trade Center towers, if they had had nuclear weapons on their aircraft, they were prepared to sacrifice their lives and wreak the enormous destruction that would come with that kind of activity. And then secondly, the weakening of the international framework and the role of the nation state, as we had seen it in the Cold War period, the growing influence for a variety of reasons of non-state entities, networks, reinforced the sense that the framework of deterrence that had controlled this weaponry had substantially broken down. So it's in this context that Ambassador Kampelman and the very distinguished group of senior personages that have published a series of op-eds and started a process of trying to really advance the Reagan vision of a world without nuclear weapons has advanced. I won't repeat what's in those two op-eds, but in January of last year and then this year, former Secretary of State George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, and former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry came out with what many people saw as really an audacious proposal that people of that seriousness lead an effort to find a way to rid the world of nuclear weapons. And there have been two conferences convened out at the Hoover Library in collaboration with Sam Nunn's Cooperative Threat Reduction Initiative. And then our speakers today have just come back from Norway, where the Norwegian Foreign Ministry hosted a conference to carry on the vision of a world without nuclear weapons. Let me just say, as I move to turn the floor over to our speakers, that today's event is sponsored by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the British American Security Information Council. And the event is really the initiative of Jim Goodby, who, again, we'll be hearing from, who has played a major role in this activity. I'll ask our speakers to lead off with Ambassador Max Kampelman. Max Max's most important assignment, as I think you all know, was as vice chairman of our board of directors. Incidentally, of course, he won the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the Presidential Citizens Medal, and has had a whole series of assignments dealing with issues of arms control and the nuclear proliferation problem. And as I mentioned earlier, he was with President Reagan and Secretary Shultz at Reykjavik and played a major role on these issues during the Reagan administration. Then George Perkovich is the vice president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where his portfolio focuses on global security and economic development issues. He's the author of a major report from Carnegie entitled Universal Compliance, A Strategy for Nuclear Security, and has done two award-winning books dealing with proliferation on the Indian subcontinent. And Jim Goodby, who I'm very pleased to say will be with the Institute for the coming year, is really the prime mover behind today's event. Jim has had five ambassadorial appointments in the area of arms control, and has published two very important books on the subject, The Greatest Danger, and a book entitled, most recently, a book, At the Borderline of Armageddon, How American Presidents Have Managed the Atomic Bomb. So with those words of introduction, again, we're delighted you're here. And Max, you're the first to tell us about Oslo and everything else that's going on.
Thank you very much. I want to, at the very outset, affirm that I do not speak here as an expert, because I don't look upon myself as an expert in a rather intricate area of public policy. But I have been exposed to this question rather deeply, and I have certain beliefs about it, certain experiences with it that I will share with you here this morning. When President Reagan was elected following his defeat of Jimmy Carter, he found Max Kampelman negotiating with the Soviets on the Helsinki process. This is an appointment that came out of the blue as far as I was concerned, but I knew quite a bit about Russia and about the Soviet Union, and was pleased when President Reagan asked me to continue negotiating with the Soviets on the issue of human rights and the other very important ingredients of the Helsinki process, the Helsinki Final Act. And that led to a relationship and led to a conclusion, which President Reagan felt, and I understood why, was the downfall of the Soviet Union and the end, really, of the Soviet Union, and particularly in Europe. This led to, obviously, a more intimate, friendly relationship. He knew I was a Democrat. It didn't seem to disturb him. As a matter of fact, he was once a Democrat himself, he reminded me. It did lead to a relationship. And I can only maybe say to you that at 5 a.m. one morning, when I was obviously back in private life, a telephone rang. A young lady identified herself as CBS News, and she asked me if I knew that Mr. Shultz and Mr. Gromyko were in Geneva trying to restore talks on nuclear weapons. Well, obviously the press was filled with that, and I was aware of that. And she went on to say, Dan Rather tells us that you're going to head the American delegation, which was totally new to me. And I explained that I thought she was making an error because I knew nothing really about this subject other than what ordinary people in public affairs know about it. But she ran. She told me she was running with a story at 6 a.m. and that I should therefore maybe turn off my phone. The fact of the matter is, I did not feel qualified. I was not qualified, and I tried not to get appointed when it was seemed to be serious. And I thought I had persuaded the decision makers that I was not the person for that job because I didn't know anything about it or enough about it. When I received the telephone call from Messrs. Schultz and Weinberg saying the president was calling me in 5 minutes, they knew I didn't want it, but I couldn't say no to the president, they said. I said, I'm not qualified. There are experts in this field, and they said, well, we'll get you a good deputy. Anyhow, the president did call me in 5 minutes, and I suppose I shouldn't be saying this publicly, but I will. He explained to me that he knew I didn't want the position and the responsibility, that I didn't feel qualified, but he knew about having negotiated with me with the Russians that I had some skill in this area. And then, as a postscript said, also, Max, you're the only one that I could get Schultz and Weinberg to agree on. which tells us something about it. But I give you that introduction because I don't want you to think that you've got an expert now at the dais talking to you. There was, shortly after my appointment, the first meeting between Reagan and the Gromyko in Geneva. This was all part of the putting the pieces back together again. When he, at the end of that meeting, he came back, the president came back to Washington and called a meeting of his people, administration people, so that he could report on his discussions with Mr. Gromyko, with Mr. Gorbachev. I was there. I listened. This is the meeting which, where he said, Maggie was right. We can do business with this man. In the course of reporting on his conversations with Mr. Gorbachev, he mentioned that he suggested to Gorbachev how desirable it would be if both we and the Russians could agree to eliminate all of our nuclear weapons. I can only say to you at this large meeting that he had of his advisors, there was consternation in that room. He listened politely to why this was not in our interest, did not respond, but he did respond at the next meeting with Gorbachev, which was in Reykjavik, where he repeated the offer in spite of what his experts had said. And those of you who are familiar a little bit more with some of these negotiations will of course know that we did, during the negotiations on arms, did agree to go to zero on INF arms and to cut the strategic arms by 50%, and we did end up with two treaties. And I'm pleased to have participated in that development. Went back to private life. And now Dick talked about 9/11. And I remember reading in the New York Times at some point that if those airplanes had carried nuclear weapons rather than what they did carry, Washington, New York, much of the eastern seaboard would have been in ruins. And as a father and as a grandfather, this moved me immensely. And I saw nothing happening in the society that was addressing this issue. And I recalled Reagan's zero and the fact that we did negotiate a zero, at least our one class, with the Russians. And I therefore took the liberty of bringing together some of my staff during those Geneva negotiations and asked them whether, in view of these developments, Reagan was right or whether they and their fellow experts were right. And a few of us from my old staff got together and concluded that we ought to do something about this issue and that the Reagan message should be restored. And this is the background, really, of the current activities. I got in touch with George Shultz and asked George if to look into this. I sent him some material. He took it up with some of the people at Stanford and the Hoover Institute. And they decided to hold the 20th anniversary of Reykjavik at the Hoover Institute at Stanford. And Mr. Shultz asked me if I would open up that that meeting. And I did. And we had a distinguished group of people who were present. We had a full discussion about it. It led to other meetings, and this past October, we had a second such meeting. Each one of those meetings led to a Wall Street Journal editorial. In the meantime, prior to that, during the summer I was working with staff, I did write an op-ed piece for the New York Times. And all I can say to you, I've never in my life received as many letters as I got as a result of that piece in the New York Times. And one of the editors of the New York Times telephoned me to say that they don't remember receiving as much mail, and they had taken the liberty of publishing the piece in the International Herald Tribune as well. I mention this to indicate the fact that there was, in my opinion, clearly a hunger in this world for doing something to stop the road to hell, really, which is what was inevitably developing in this transformation. There was a time when it was really just we and the Soviet Union. These days, I've heard two figures. One figure says 27 countries now have or are en route to this destructive capacity. There may be more. I don't know. I do know that we attempted to bribe. We did bribe North Korea. They don't stay bribed, so we bribed them again. In my opinion, they will not stay bribed. We're trying to bribe Iran now. I have a feeling they'll accept the bribe, and it won't give me security and shouldn't give any of us security with respect to that development that I really think is now characteristic. Now, in the course of my activities, and you can see from what I've said that I've really concentrated my time on this in this area, even though I'm fully aware of my inadequacies with respect to the technical questions that are involved here. but I know what ought to be. And I want to say a word about the question of ought to be, because I really think that there's a strength in that, even though, you know, what I frequently hear is, well, yes, it ought to be, but, you know, it's not practical. I used to teach political science before coming to Washington. This was a long time ago. Gunnar Myrdal had put out a book, and I told my classes that Carnegie wanted to study the Negro in America. This would have been the late 1940s, so I don't mean to disclose my age to you, but it was in the late 1940s, early 50s, and they didn't want an American to do this study of the American Negro, and they got a hold of Gunnar Myrdal, a Swedish economist. And he came out with two volumes, and I explained to the class, I didn't ask them to read the two volumes, but I explained to the class that he had said in his book, introduction, he thought he knew America. He'd been in America many times, but now, of course, he was on a special assignment, and he found something that impressed him immensely. He found that wherever he went in America, talking to Democrats, Republicans, socialists, men, women, children, whites, blacks, Indians, there was a common thread, he said, that he discovered throughout the country. And it was a thread which can best be represented by the Declaration of